All right, we're here at Jim Gardner's office, Carolina's...
Martin.
Jim Martin, excuse me.
You're just with Gardner, that's all.
All these Jims.
Good idea.
James Martin's office at Carolina's Medical Center. And here to talk about Republican Party and North Carolina politics since the 60s. So why don't we start off by... you could tell us something maybe about your boyhood. You grew up in Savannah and then in South Carolina.
Well, I was born in Savannah, Georgia. Grew up in Winnsboro, South Carolina. Attended public schools there. It's called Mount Zion Institute. Zion with a Z. And it was a small class so that all of us had to participate in everything. So I lettered in football, basketball, track. Didn't quite make it for baseball. Couldn't hit a curve. But was in the band, the chorus, the quartet, all of the intellectual organizations, you know, the Latin Club, so forth. So I participated in all of that and had a big time. I went to Davidson College as an undergraduate, and then after getting a doctorate in chemistry from Princeton University, came back to Davidson to teach. My early political involvement was nil until I returned to Davidson and decided to I had to make a decision how to register, but I decided to get more involved than just registering and chose to join the Republican Party, not so much because of philosophic considerations, but because I thought it was very important to help build a two-party system, and you couldn't do it by just lining up with the monolithic party that was dominant all across the South in those days. If you remember in the 50s and 60s, in fact even up through the 70s, most Southern conservatives were Democrats. Most Southern Democrats were conservative. So there's no philosophical reason to join the Republican Party at that time. But I also was offended by the fact that there was not good opposition to the dominant party, and therefore the dominant party didn't behave as it should and as it would have if it had strong opposition.
How did you see the dominant party misbehaving in those years?
Well, it was autocratic, it was not accountable, it was entrenched, it was not approachable. Again, remember that I was not an experienced active citizen when I made that choice. I was a young fellow right out of graduate school. It was time for me to register. Yes, I admired Dwight Eisenhower, and I attribute a lot of the growth of two-party politics in the South to the election of Eisenhower in 52 and 56. In fact, you go back and look at a book written by Dr. Hurd, I believe it, Dr. Alexander
Hurd
of Vanderbilt University. It's published in 1951 or 52, and the title of it is A Question, A Two-Party South. And the book proceeds to answer that question in the negative. It'll never happen that the Democrats in the South are not going to vote for a Republican. It's too close to Sherman's March, and that's a characterization of a lot of things related to the war between the states, and so they won't do it. They'll find some excuse, such as the Dixiecrat Party, and if they can't vote for the Democrats, they'll vote for something like that, a Dixiecrat offshoot, because they could not bring themselves genetically to vote for Republicans. Well, that was the year, 52, that Eisenhower was elected, and while he didn't care much of the South, he set the seeds in place for the growth of a two-party system in the old South. People registered and got actively involved in helping him. That gave us the nucleus of some workers. The congressional race here in Charlotte went to a Republican that year, 1952, Charles Raper Jonas, who generally is regarded as the father of Republican Party in North Carolina, just because he's the first major figure elected for a series of terms. Actually, his father had served one term with Hoover, and just one term, and then was back out. And Jonas got in, and what he did was to teach people how to pick the best candidates with whom they agreed, rather than to just vote the straight party line. So he taught people how to split their ticket. The Democrats then proceeded to redistrict him as frequently as they could to put him up against other incumbent Democratic congressmen in hopes that they could beat him, take away Republican base that he had, give him Democratic voters from neighboring districts in tortuous looking districts that they drew. That we call them Jonasmander districts. Yeah, right. The gerrymander was for Mr. Jerry in Massachusetts, and so we call these the Jonasmander. And one of them even looked like a dragon with a tail and wings and so forth. And yet what resulted from that was that he defeated their incumbents, taught new Democrat voters how to split their ticket and vote for Republicans, and the people that he had previously taught that had been taken away from him became the nucleus of the group that elected Jim Broyhill in 1962, and then later Earl Ruth from Salisbury and Wilmer Mizell from Winston-Salem. That was going on in the 60s, and that was part of what I wanted to contribute to. And so I chose to register as a Republican. There weren't many in our district, but I found some students who were willing to get involved, and we organized as best we could a grassroots operation in Davidson, North Carolina, in which our filing system, this was before computers, our filing system was a shoebox with index cards, along the edge of which would be black markings from a crayon on a pattern that would indicate whether this person was one who had voted many times for Republicans, or just for Jonas, or just for Eisenhower, or occasionally in that way. And we went out after those who were most likely to vote for more Republicans before we went after the ones that would vote for some Republicans, and that way helped to build up the political base for Republican candidates in that precinct. Now, that precinct, as we started out, would typically vote for any Democrat 6-1, 8-1, something on an overwhelming majority. After we worked at it that next election, our Republicans only got beat 3-1, but the way I look at that, we doubled our vote.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big step.
and today, that precinct of Davidson, North Carolina, because of continued organizational strength and because of some influx of retired business people who moved into there, that precinct is now a toss-up. The best candidates of both parties will win. And we've seen that going on all over the state. If I can continue that theme a moment, even as governor of North Carolina, I had many public policy issues. I had an agenda of trying to build better schools and better roads and better jobs, but I didn't shirk the responsibility of building a better, healthier, more competitive two-party system. And so we went after voters to persuade as many Democrats as we could who thought like Republicans and voted for Republicans and wanted to see Republicans elected to register as Republicans and help us to organize a base. What we saw was still a handicap for us was that if everybody registered as Democrats and then voted for just those Republicans that they knew about and agreed with and knew that they agreed with them, then the only Republicans that would win would be those that were highly visible. the candidates for county commissioner and school board and city council, judges, sheriffs, would not be as visible and would get crushed year after year. And the impact of two-party politics would be limited just to the highly visible level. And you see, what would happen is that after a voter, a ticket splitter, votes, the person who votes for the best candidates of each party, once they voted for their candidates, for the candidates that they know about, which would include some Republicans, then you get down to the bottom of the ballot and hear a lot of people they don't know anything about. So what do? Chances are they'll revert to their party, however they're registered. And by building up a stronger Republican registration, we believed that it would lead to greater parity in all parts of the election ballot, and that's been the case. That's been proven out. As we got some Democrats to switch their allegiance, as we got some Democratic candidates to switch, as we took away conservative strength from the Democratic ranks, one of the things that happened was it became more difficult for a conservative Democrat to win the primaries in their party. And that being the case, it became even less attractive for conservatives to remain within the Democratic Party, as more and more would change registration, defect, if you want to call it that, come over to put their registration where their heart and mind was in the Republican Party. Then the remainder, the residue in the Democratic Party, by default, became more liberal.
So do you see the
Republican... that drove even more conservatives into the Republican ranks.
So you see the growth of the two-party system offering voters and citizens a greater choice then of policy options. Instead of having, say, two conservative parties, you get different voices. Is that a fair construction of...
Well, absolutely. That's a part of it. I don't know that I was that sophisticated as I began to look at it. I just saw that there was only one party. Mm-hmm. I remember we had a visit to Davidson when I was teaching there and had begun organizing our students, but we had a visit from the then lieutenant governor of the state of North Carolina, and he came in and said to the students, it was one of these mandatory assemblies that all Davidson students had to attend in those days, and he said, I want you to understand one thing about North Carolina. The Democratic Party runs this state. Well, I thought that was kind of blatant. I didn't shout out any invective from the balcony where I was sitting, but I became even more convinced that that was an attitude that was justified then, but that had to be changed. And the way to change it was to become more and more actively involved in political organization, as well as the philosophical principles that I believed in. Fortunately, the party that I chose, the Republican Party, quickly became the more conservative party. Generally across the country then, and certainly it's true now, that in any district, any legislative district, any state, the Republican opponent will be the more conservative and the Democrat will be the more liberal. The Democrat may be a conservative Democrat, but will not be as conservative as the Republican opposition. The Republican in some states might be a fairly liberal Republican, but will not be as liberal as the Democrat opposition. And so there was, there was a stronger and stronger split between the two parties along philosophical lines. But in the South, in 1960, that was not well developed at all, because almost everybody was Democrat, and therefore almost all conservatives were Democrats, and therefore almost all Democrats were conservatives, or a majority of them.
Thinking back...
That's no longer the case.
No, it's
and I've enjoyed being a part of changing it.
Did you know any Republicans when you were growing up?
The little town that I grew up in, Winnsboro, South Carolina, is even today a stronghold of the Democratic Party. I know today a couple of Republicans in that county, but I don't think there were Republicans when I was growing up. I don't think there were any.
How were Republicans thought of when you were told about Republicans on front porches or wherever? How were they described, or what image was conjured up?
Well, they weren't talked about much because there wasn't anything to them. I mean, I don't mean that in a spiritual sense. Certainly, if I'd known who they were, I might have seen that there was a lot of nobility in them, but but didn't know who they were. They weren't visible. They weren't active. They could barely scrape up 5% of the vote, and maybe half of that was marking the wrong square. It just was not an active movement in the South. It was like a curiosity. I'm not aware of anybody who took drugs during my childhood days, but I remember conversation about the curiosity of there's a lady down the street who's a drug addict. I didn't know what that meant. My generation came up with different problems than later generations did. In the same way, if there was any discussion of Republican, it didn't mean anything. It was not of any consequence. It was not a threat to the Democratic strongholds. It was at most a curiosity in those days. I've made the illustration that about the only reason then for someone to become a Republican was to become postmaster if Eisenhower got elected. So I refer in my speeches on this subject to the GOP as standing for great opportunities for postmaster.
Yep, that's...
And now, of course, that's been relatively depoliticized. It's not the patronage plum that it used to be. It's a civil service job. And the Republican Party has grown far beyond that to where we're now competitive. We are more than half the Democratic registration today in North Carolina. We register by party and we vote in primaries by party. Not all southern states do that, but in North Carolina we do. And when I was elected governor, the ratio of Republicans and to Democrats was 1 to 6 or 7, about that ratio. It meant that when I was elected governor in 1984, I had to get more, and did get more, Democrat votes than there were Republicans. Mm-hmm. If I got all the Republicans, I'd have to get more votes from Democrats, and I probably didn't get them all. You know, so the campaigns then had to appeal to people to split the ticket and vote for the candidate with whom you're most comfortable and you have confidence in. But it was clear that I wanted to build a Republican Party, and today the Republican registration is greater than half the Democrat, so it's not quite 2-to-1 Democrat advantage.
And a lot of that growth,
and that's still registration.
Right.
There's still some Democrats who are registered Democrats, but who align themselves philosophically and in response to questionnaires and in the way they vote for visible candidates. They act like Republicans. Mm-hmm. There's still some who are registered Democrats who act like Republicans. Obviously, it would have to be in order to get a majority.
Mm-hmm. And you used to honor those people as governor when you're giving a speech, have them stand,
yeah,
and
still
the
do.
Republicans
clap
for them.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
Did many of them come into the Republican Party that way, feeling honored, and then come through the gate that you opened up?
Or? Well, we gave it our best shot. I mean, it was in effect an altar call, first to have them stand up and be recognized and applauded for voting with us, regardless of how they were registered. But then there would also be a closing invitation that that if they truly believed, and if they came to believe that the Republican Party candidates represented their goals and aspirations for America, for North Carolina, for their hometown better than the Democrats did, then they ought to put their registration where their heart was, and many did that. Mm-hmm. And we had some campaigns where there was some visibility for those who did, but the momentum kept going before and after that. It's been a gradual thing, and so it may have happened anyway, But somebody had to be involved in it, and I was, we were, and we were very happy to have seen it succeed. Wasn't unique, because you've seen the same thing happening in other southeastern states. Some changes, I'd say until recently, until the last election, Georgia was still dominated by Democrats, except for an occasional member of Congress and a few county commissioners. And that's like North Carolina was in the 60s and 70s. But today, the congressional delegation has been profoundly changed down there, and it has here. We went from being, I think, 3 Republicans and 8 Democrats to 8 Republicans and 4 Democrats. Big switch.
Georgia did basically the same. Now it's interesting.
South Carolina?
3 black Democrats and then 8 white Republicans. Yep. So there's.
And you know, that is another expression of the continuing racial phenomena of Southern politics. It's been there and it's going to be there for a while, and hopefully someday we grow out of that. But the outcome now is that most of the Southern Democratic members of Congress, I mean, they're mostly black. And that's because of the change in the party, but it's also because, very importantly, because of the way in which congressional districts have been drawn to see that they could get elected. And aside from the appeal of that, one of the consequences is that it took away strength from other Democrats who were more conservative or who were white or whatever. And hopefully, I think it'll benefit both parties if we can grow out of that to where the participation of blacks in both parties and the standing of both parties with black and white voters alike is less polarized along racial lines, but we just haven't outgrown that yet.
Well,
that's not a new thing. That's an age-old right. problem of Southern politics.
You tried to bring blacks into the Republican Party in ways that, you know, Jim Gardner thought was a waste of time, just because the alignment is so strong there. What did you find most successful in bringing blacks into the Republican Party?
I don't know that he would have said it was a waste of time, because I think he respected the fact that I was able to do it. Not all candidates were able to do that. But we made a conscious effort of recruiting campaign workers from the racial minority community, of finding professionals and business people who were not tied into the Democratic machinery and who didn't respect the monolithic way in which the Democratic Party had organized the black voting into blocks, block voting in southern cities. And we had some success at that. It wasn't overwhelming. I guess when I ran for Congress the first time, I probably got 2% of the black vote. You can't be sure, because there wasn't any exit poll to tell you what people said they did, but if you looked at those precincts that then were essentially 100% black, I'd get 2% of the vote. And so you extrapolate that to the ones that were more transitional populations of some other precincts and generalize. May not be so, but that appeared to be it. And then my second campaign, we got that up to 4%, and the third campaign, it was up to, we didn't double it again, we got up to almost 7. And we kept working at it, winning more recruits and hoping that they would speak up for me and help me with community gatherings that were of a political nature to get people to speak for me and to vote for me. But we couldn't make a dent in the delivery system that the Democratic Party had then of paying campaign workers to be the lieutenants to organize the turnout in those black precincts. You remember the embarrassment that the Republicans had in the New Jersey election for Governor Quitman, Ed Rawlings, said something about paying the preachers and the street people to speak up for the Republicans. And he got burned for it. And the irony of it is that that wasn't something that the Republicans had been doing very well. That was something the Democrats had been doing. And any attempt to criticize them with it never got any attention. It was ignored. Maybe it was seen as sour grapes on our part. He drew attention to it, but it was as if he was the culprit.
Yeah, he drew some lightning.
Right, he drew the lightning. But that's been going on, and it's weakening. It's not as strong as it was. And so I'm hopeful that eventually there will be more openness. I recruited from among those business and professional African Americans in North Carolina who had worked with our campaign, a good cadre of people who participated in my government at all kinds of levels of activity, and in fact went far beyond what the record that had been set by any Democrat or Republican, but certainly by any Democrat. The Democrats had the loyalty and allegiance of over 90% of the black voters in North Carolina. And that was a major fraction of their voting base. I'm going to make a guess that it would probably amount to, in those days, 40% of the total vote that they would get. But they didn't come anywhere close to 40% of their jobs in state government for the blacks that had supported them. And I went far beyond the support level that I had gotten because I thought it was part of building bridges to say that if you're willing to serve in my administration, I know you're qualified because your credentials are there. I want you to serve and help us to say that we'll go beyond our proportional share of the black vote in hiring and appointing blacks to salaried positions as well as boards and commissions, of seeing that minority-owned businesses get a much bigger share of the state contracts than they'd ever gotten before. You know, it's funny. When I started looking at that, I knew that while the black population might be 22% of the total population, the minority-owned businesses didn't make anything close to that as a percentage of all businesses, because most businesses have stockholders. You know, who knows what race they are. A lot of it's institutional stockholders. It has nothing to do with that. But there were some small businesses that were owned and operated and run by blacks. And so I set a goal of 2%, and that we'd get 2% of the state purchasing contracts would go to minority-owned businesses. And we didn't set it aside. We didn't have quotas. What we said is, that's what we're going to try to do. And then we talked to our people and said, see if you can find some qualified minority-owned businesses. We'll help you qualify them, but see if you can find them and offer them some business. Some work had to be done on a low bid basis, above a certain dollar level. But if it's below that dollar level, instead of just giving it to your cronies and your old buddies, instead of just giving it to the same old Democrats that had it all along, give it to some minority-owned businesses and see if they get a share of it. We don't have a quota for it. You don't get thrown in jail if you don't meet it.
Right. Well, it is a quota in a way, but it's taken.
Well, it's a goal.
It's
a goal. And at first, the thoughtful black supporters would say, well, now, wait a minute. A goal is empty. That's another hollow promise. It doesn't go anywhere. I said, well, let's see where we are a year from now. And others said, well, Jim Hunt, my predecessor, a Democrat, a lot more liberal in those days than he is now. You know, times are changing. But they chided me. The editorial was that Hunt had set a goal of 5%. Yeah, but he only achieved 0.015%.
Is that right?
Because he didn't do anything to achieve the goal. And so by focusing it and saying we're going to reach out and find people and we're going to keep score, and it'll be one of the things you get graded on, but you don't get fired if you can't make any score on that, because a lot of other things you got to do. And they have to be good, qualified people, and we don't want any chicanery. If you get involved in something that involves payola to choose who gets it, then you will get fired for that, because that's criminal. But the end result was that we achieved not just 2%, we achieved 4%. So then we set a goal of 5%. And nobody could ever say that, and nobody ever was denied an opportunity to do business with the state because they were white or because they were Democrat. But some blacks got to do business with the state and learn how to do business, and then later on were invited to submit competitive bids for some of the larger contracts. And some have succeeded. We did the same thing with prison construction. Not to say that each contractor has to have a percentage set aside for minority contractors, but just to say that all the construction that we do, some of that work's going to minority subcontractors.
Then, did you notice some of these contractors and their workers supporting Republican candidates coming into the party?
Yes.
So
there's a base there, and that base, of course, is reinforced by the writings of Walter Williams and others, African-American philosophers who have written about these issues. And so I think we help to reinforce that too. Are we going to get those voters of any race who are most liberal? Probably not. Not most of them. Will we get most of those who are conservative, whatever their race? Yeah, probably so.
Entrepreneurs. Yep. Interesting. Well, going back to the 60s, when race was such a tangible issue after the Civil Rights Act of 65 and like that, did you sense a difference in the party and the priorities that Republicans of North Carolina had, East versus West? You ran for your first office, or your first successful one was 66. And Johnson, of course, had plummeted. Goldwater was, you know, forgotten, and Johnson was the new villain. What was it like campaigning in that year, and how did you sense divisions within the Republican Party?
I didn't have much exposure to politics outside this county when I was running for county commissioner. After I was elected, I got to meet some of the other people, Wilma Mizell, Jim Gardner, Charlie Jonas Jr., Holzhauser's team of people. He was party chairman at about that time, Jim Holzhauser.
Yeah, came in 66.
But it was through mostly social events where we'd get together and have a tag football game. And I remember scoring the winning touchdown over Wilmer Mizell.
Oh, really? He was a professional baseball player,
right.
So that...
Well, right. And I'm sure he was a good football player, too. I got the touchdown. And then we'd visit a little bit and get to know people and begin to build networks, but there wasn't much in the late 60s to unify Republicans except for those few who went to state conventions. It used to be joked that the Republican Party could hold its convention in a phone booth. I mean, you've heard that expression.
Sure.
It's not original, I guess, with Republicans, but it was a characterization of that period of time. And yet by the mid-70s, when there was some internecine struggle within the Republican Party between those who supported Holzhauser primarily and those who primarily supported Senator Helms, during that period, we began to get much bigger attendance at the conventions because a lot more was at stake. Now, my participation in that rivalry, that rift of the party, I think is, to me, is very interesting because I realize that it's important to recruit new people into the party, and they have to be able to participate and get actively involved and win some of those internal struggles from time to time, or else they're not going to be there. Their loyalty will not attach to us. And so I saw value in that, but I also saw the danger if you don't find some way to heal those wounds. And one of my initiatives, which was a lonely one at first, and then later won more support, was to bring the Helms team and the Holzhauser team, or I had inherited more of Governor Holzhauser's support, to bring the Helms team and the Martin team together. Senator Helms and I had always gotten along fine. We still do. And yet his organization greeted my candidacy for governor with a brief but very intense effort to recruit somebody to beat me.
Bill Kobe.
Bill Kobe, yeah. And they had every right to do that. But I felt that after having exercised that right, it was time for us to build things together and make the base stronger for both sides. If I could not win re-election in 88 for lack of support from the very conservative side of the Republican Party, then how would Senator Helms be able to win in 1990 without the support of the moderately conservative side of the Republican Party? There had to be a stronger blending, and they understood that, and the North Carolina Congressional Club, Tom Ellis, Carter Wren, recognized that. They heard me out. They gave me a hearing. They came over and talked with me about it. No, I was not willing to turn over my campaign organization to their control, but I needed their support, and I needed them to be visibly identified as supporting my campaign. Tom Ellis had a couple of fundraisers at his home that raised some good money for me, and what that did was to close the issue as to whether we were divided and opposed. And I have to give him credit for being willing to meet me on that. And I also take credit for initiating it, because I thought it would be very important for the party down the road. After we've been through our struggles, we'll bring people in, then let's see how to unify those, still allowing for occasional battles. When it came up to a choice of party chairman in 1972, right after Jim Holzhauser was elected, he had defeated Jim Gardner, who had been our candidate in 68. But in 72, the party chairman, my good friend Frank Rouse, supported Gardner. And when Holzhauser won a squeaker on a runoff campaign, then Holzhauser his people got together and replaced Frank Rouse. And I guess that was sort of the first expression of a rift between those two wings of the party. The Helms team sided with Gardner and with Frank Rouse, and that's understandable. But I took advantage of the fact that Frank was one of my allies, and he helped me to build relationships across the spectrum of the party. I don't regard myself as a very conservative, but I regard myself as a conservative.
Often.
I mean, if I was 88% and Senator Helms was 100% or 98%, surely there'd be some things that on record votes he would go one way and I would go another. The way I explained that was that, well, he was so well established that he got to define which side of an issue was a conservative issue. I didn't get to define that. I wasn't that prominent in those days. That was a joke. But I certainly was conservative.
No, certainly.
88% writing on all of the conservative groups, American Constitutional Action.
Up in the 90s by a number of them.
On some of them, yeah. Business organizations that would be higher.
Sure. Fiscal issues being close to your heart.
Right.
Was there almost an unofficial agreement then?
Well, maybe I was just more consistent on fiscal issues than I was on social issues. Mm-hmm. Let me think of what year it was. 1970 was Martin Luther King assassinated in 69 or 70?
68.
68?
It was a very tumultuous year.
All right, 68. I was county commission chairman. That's right, it's my second. Let me think again. Yeah, it was the end of my first term as a county commissioner. I was chairman of the county commission. And at that time, I made a public statement in a community gathering that I hoped would heal wounds and ease some of the strains that inflamed some of the southern cities, and called on people of all parties to see if we couldn't find a way to rise above and beyond the housing restrictions so that housing choices would be open to anybody within our community. And of course that didn't produce the response I had hoped it was, but then I learned a lot from that, because there were a lot of people who felt very intensely that the law should continue to restrain where people could choose to live, and should support business decisions that would exclude black families from choosing where they wanted to live. And yet there's an interesting sequel to that. When I ran for Congress in 72, I knew that Phil Van Every, former mayor of Charlotte, Republican, CEO of Lance Incorporated, big food product manufacturer here, crackers and so forth. I knew that he had disagreed with my statement back in 1968. But he called me to come to his office and wanted to meet with me. One of my supporters was very close to him, Marcus Hickman. And Marcus had been party chairman, local attorney, good friend. Asked him to at least see me and talk with him. Well, I went to his office, and he had some of his other executives there just for introduction to get acquainted, and then he asked them to leave, and the two of us stayed in the room. And I was seated. He was standing, which meant that my head was turned up and my throat was dry, and I remembered how I'd felt when a used car salesman had sold me a car I didn't want in that very same physical relationship. And so there he was standing, big, powerful, bushy eyebrows, and he quickly went to the subject that I knew was coming. He said, "How do you feel about open housing?" Well, he knew how I felt. He knew what I'd said. And the only thing I could say was to repeat what I'd said and give a very brief, not argumentative, but brief outline of the things that I considered important, but not to insult him by trying to argue it with him. Wouldn't be any point in that. And so I told him that, yes, that he might remember that I had made a public statement in favor of eliminating legal restrictions on where people live and legal protections for business decisions that discriminated in that way. And he looked at me with those bushy eyebrows bearing down, and I thought I was about to get thrown out, and he said, "I'm going to support you." After that one question and that one answer, which was the wrong answer for him, he said, "I knew how you felt about it. I wanted to see if you would back off under a little bit of pressure that I could put on you." Mm-hmm. He said, if we win and you go to Congress, you will never hear from me about how you should vote. I will trust you to study issues as I would want to study them if I were there, and make your best decision, and I have confidence in your integrity. He said, had you backed off and caved in under this little pressure, I would have had no confidence that you could stand up to some real pressure once you get up there. And there's even a funny sequel to that. My second term, I went on the Ways and Means Committee. And very quickly heard from a lobbyist who told me that the fig paste industry wanted me to support a bill, wanted me to introduce a bill to eliminate the tariff on imported fig paste. And I said, well, I'll be glad to look at it. Is there a fig industry in the United States? He said, yes, in California. And I said, well, I think I ought to talk with my colleagues. He said, no, you don't need to talk with anybody. Lance is in your district, and they make fig bars. And so you are the one we want to introduce this. You're new on the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee. And I tried to make the point to him that that wasn't my style. And he said, well, Phil Van Every was a strong supporter of yours. And I said, well, then let's call Phil and see what he wants to do. And I got him. I had his number. I called him. He had not called me on anything. And I told him that there was a gentleman here in my office who believes that I should introduce a bill on behalf of the fig paste industry. And he's not interested in my finding out the pros and cons of the tariff. And Van Every said, let me talk to him. So I handed the phone to the guy and watched him while he said yes and no and yes and no, and his face turned red. He handed me back he said goodbye and handed me back the phone, and I hung it up, and it was dead at that point. And he just walked out of the room. Phil Van Every told him that, you know, either make his case in a convincing, rational basis that I could intellectually believe in, or get out of there. So he made good on his commitment. That's a side angle that may not be of any interest to you. I've mentioned it in a couple of my speeches along the way, but it meant a lot to me, obviously.
Sure.
I learned a lot about myself.
Yeah, to trust your convictions, and when you trust in somebody is looking for that, it does make a difference.
If you're true to your convictions, then there may be some people who will be so far polarized against you that they can't support you, but most reasonable people will respect that. And I think that's the key for any modern politician dealing with the abortion issue. And I'm not the only one to come to this conclusion. Lee Atwater expressed it very well, that you have to have a position. You can't be oblivious. You have to believe something about it and the various issues that come up within that general area of abortion policy. Back on record.
Yes, we're back and rolling again.
Exceptions for rape and incest, promptly reported or not, all those kinds of issues have a lot to do with whether the public taxes should be used to pay for that. And so the conclusion I had is you've got to have a position on that, and so study it, consider it very prayerfully, and then decide how you feel about it, and answer anybody's question consistently. Don't try to be all things to all people, but be consistent and clear, even if sometimes it's 60% one way or another time it's 60% another way on some variation on that theme. Whatever your view is, at least have it your view and answer the question the same way to each group. Don't try to persuade both groups that you're on both sides. Don't make it the fulcrum of your campaign. It's a legitimate issue. Take a stand on it. But don't make it the sole basis of your campaign, because if you do, then you get the vast majority of people who are not idealistically deployed on the extremes of that issue. They're not going to trust you. But if you take a view either on the left or on the right or in the middle and you stick with that, you will lose only those who are polarized against you. And the vast majority will accept that you're willing to study it and make your own decision.
Pat Buchanan seems to be following that advice. When he was speaking to the Perot Convention, he got to abortion, and most folks there were pro-choice. And he says, it's divisive, you know where I stand. And he moved on. I mean, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. And there is potential dynamite.
Don't make it the drumbeat. Yeah.
Republican Party. I just reviewed a book and it had a survey of Republican grassroots workers all across the South. And a majority are pro-choice, which surprised me, shocked me, but that's what their survey results showed.
Mm-hmm. But it depends on the issue. If you ask pro-choice in apocalyptic terms of a constitutional amendment to prohibit all abortion, I would say, no, I'm not in favor of that. Okay, am I pro-choice? I'm not in favor of paying for a change of heart, you know, for a decision that is economically based or anything of that sort, cosmetic adjustment. I would be willing to pay for an abortion of a Medicaid-eligible person, otherwise eligible for Medicaid, provided it was induced by rape or incest promptly reported so that the authorities could deal with the violation and the violator, if indeed there was one. But that still allows for a medical choice to be made, and it covers it where there is a medical or criminal aspect related to it. Now, that's not the view of a lot of people, but it was a view that I had. But wherever you come down on that issue, let's say even someone who is pro-choice on the constitutional issue and would be opposed to a constitutional amendment may not be in favor of a system which deals with a young girl who gets pregnant without respect for her parents being a part of her family. And so the issue of informed parental consent comes up. And to me, it's legitimate to make some room for exceptions if there is danger at home and the courts can function in loco parentis. But at least there's some adult, legally constituted basis for helping to make that decision, not just the young girl facing those who want to recruit her to carry out, to do the abortion. Who pays for it and how, that's another thing. If people want to contribute their private funds to pay for it, they can do that. Someone who is denied an abortion because they can't afford to, it could certainly appeal to those who are willing to contribute their own money.
A private fund.
Yeah, sure, why not? Remember that Jesus said, go and take all that you have and sell it and give it to the poor. He didn't say go tax somebody else and bestow their money for every imaginable purpose. And there's a tough, you know, that's a tough choice for us Christians to figure out how to be true to that and to meet our stewardship responsibilities on both sides of it. Well, Jonathan, has that covered most of the bases you want, or is there something that's...
Well, a few other questions. Watergate is something I thought you might have some insight on, how Watergate affected the Republican Party in North Carolina. You had a squeaker election there, your closest. It seemed to decimate the ranks of party workers.
Yeah.
Just curious what you...
When I ran in 1972, which was the Watergate year, I was very closely aligned with President Nixon. I had been a delegate to the 1968 convention supporting him. The majority of our delegation had supported Ronald Reagan in 1968.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Remember, with Jim Gardner being the candidate for governor and leading the majority of the delegation. I had stayed or chose to align with Nixon, and I thought he was most electable and supported him. And in 72, I was very comfortable running with him. He was going to be a very strong reelection campaign. It helped me. I tried to help it. And I even had a little campaign slogan that a vote for Martin is like two votes for Nixon. There's a lot of ways you can interpret that. In 1974, after he left office, the news media repeated that a lot more than they did when I was running for in 72. Yeah, I got no free coverage of that slogan. I had to buy time to use that slogan in 72. But in 74, it was the lead-in for any talk show that I appeared on.
Wow.
They just ran the tape. And as a freshman congressman, I was not on the committee that dealt with it. I was not, didn't have a law background, so I was not on judiciary. I was then on interior and science and astronautics. But I made a decision, as I realized increasingly that there were some problems there, that my job was to be a grand jury member, not to go on the basis of unsworn evidence that was traipsed through the news media day after day. That didn't mean that other people, my constituents, couldn't make decisions based on the hearsay and the rumor and the gossip and the leaks, which were a tidal wave, it turned out. But I tried to stand for a position that until there's some sworn testimony and we can confront advocates on both sides and see what evidence there is, I was going to withhold making a decision. Well, politically, that was not acceptable. People were demanding, it was a firestorm of demands. And so I probably suffered some from that, but maybe my standing by a reasonable conviction appealed to enough people that I got by in 1974. My opponent in 1974 made fairly gentle references to the Nixon episode. Maybe it's because he was enough of a gentleman, this is Milton Short, he was enough of a gentleman to realize that I was not present at Watergate, had nothing to do with the decisions of the White House. But he, of course, still tried to tie me to that embarrassment. But what really happened, he realized he couldn't tie me to it, to what had happened. He could tie me philosophically to it, but that wasn't necessarily bad. My philosophy and Nixon's philosophy were still popular in this district. But what did happen, which injured me politically as to the outcome, was that a lot of our workers were demoralized and therefore wouldn't come out and work. And they just didn't have their heart in it. When they would work in phone banks, they got snarling responses from too many people and they didn't enjoy it. And so they backed off and stopped making calls. And when your precinct workers, your grassroots organization doesn't work, then you don't get the vote turnout. I won in 1974. I think I recall that the margin was about 4 or 5% versus 10% approximately.
9,000 votes.
Yeah. Sorry. In fact, it was nearly. Yeah, it was about 10% in 72, but close in 74. But that was not the closest race I had. The closest was the following time in 76 when Gerald Ford was up for election. And at that time, most Republicans who were going to work figured that I was a shoo-in because I'd survived the 74 election.
Oh, exactly.
And so they worked for Ford. And I could understand that, but it left me with an organization that was pulled together late. And that was a fundamental problem, and we had the closest campaign I ever had as a member of Congress. The vote then was just over 50%. It was like 50.5%. And the opponent was the weakest opponent I ever faced.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Arthur Goodman had run for a state legislature and usually finished last in the Democratic primary. And if Republicans got elected, he got beat. And so he's not a strong candidate, about as weak as he was. His family had been active in politics, but he was not an effective politician. But he came closer than anybody ever did.
Did any of the closeness from that race stem from some of the other interesting dynamics that year? You backed Ford, you're wholeheartedly behind Ford, and he had fought with Reagan in the primary. This is North Carolina, the state, of course, has saved Reagan's career.
Yeah, I expect there's something to that, Jonathan. It may be part of what conditioned me that I wanted to unify the party as governor rather than to engage in exciting battles within the party year after year, just to prove that I could win those. Mm-hmm. But in 76, Ford had won the nomination, but you remember he had, just before the North Carolina primary, Governor Holzhauser had publicly called on Reagan to withdraw.
I didn't remember that.
And
didn't know that.
He didn't. He came to North Carolina and carried North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And so that meant that the erosion of Gerald Ford's position in the party continued for another month, because the Reagan campaign was emboldened by that. Senator Helms was very much involved in the Reagan campaign and did a good job of promoting his candidate. Again, it's a free country and you're entitled to do that, but the Republican Party, the party behind Governor Holzhauser, tried to avoid that battle.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say they sensed that Ford as incumbent president was going to be the nominee, and so let's get this over and don't kill ourselves over it. And yet the others felt that they had to stand true with Ronald Reagan,
mm-hmm.
Whom I greatly admire. But then I was for Ford.
Right.
And it may be that that weakened Ford so much that a lot of our workers who would have been there if Ford appeared to be strong in North Carolina and strong nationally, that might have gotten more workers out from the more moderately conservative part of the party, and we might have been stronger then. So that's the one I really squeaked by. It was 76.
Well,
Carter carried. Carter was strong. He was a new breed of Democrat, as Bill Clinton would like to say. Trust me.
Also, in
76, they tore us up that year.
so many of the party workers seemed demoralized because Ford was tied to Nixon having pardoned him. And you and Governor Holzhauser, first sitting Republican governor of the state since Russell back in the 19th century, denied admission to the national convention. Did that sort of thing have sort of a ill fallout for you in your campaign, do you think? Or?
Well, of course, that was all involved. Sometimes a controversy like that weakens you, sometimes it strengthens you. But look at the fact that I was running against my weakest opponent of all time and had the closest race. You have to conclude that all of those factors, or most of them, must have been working against me. But also the fact that most of the campaign workers that I first approached had already committed to work for President Ford, or had already committed to their church or something. We had a late primary that year, and so it wasn't until very late that we knew there was going to be an opponent. Should have assumed it all along and been battle ready, but we weren't. We organized late. And so all of those things were a factor. I'm glad they didn't rise up and smite me down, all those factors. But we survived that and came back stronger the next year. The key thing was at 76, I don't see it as a Watergate impact. 74 was a Watergate impact. 76 was related to that only because of the pardon. And I don't know that many of my supporters disagreed with the pardon.
Just put it behind and drag it out.
In my first term as governor, I went to see Richard Nixon and invited him to come down to North Carolina. And he came to Winston-Salem and we had a nice event for him, one of his first outings.
Yeah, that is early. How was
he thoroughly, it was wonderful. Even the reporters seemed awed, and that entranced me to see these tough, hard-shell reporters who always have the hard line that they can shoot at anybody, standing there watching Nixon absorbing some new strength from these people. They didn't see him as a threat to get out on the campaign trail as a candidate again. They just saw him as an individual, a human, who had been beaten down pretty good and who was still able to draw strength from people who came to see him. He was signing books that he'd written, people brought him. It was a great occasion.
What about Brad Hayes? How important was he as a
tremendous
strategist for your campaign?
Brad Hayes and I built two careers on each other, his and mine. I was his principal candidate, though he did have some other congressional candidates in other states and in North Carolina. And then when I ran for governor, he was still a part of my team, and he had worked with the Holzhauser campaign when they won statewide, and so he knew the state very well. Brad Hayes was a genius regarding North Carolina Republican politics. He was a good technician, I'd say an excellent technician, in the skills of polling and fundraising, direct mail, as well as event-oriented fundraising, as well as hand-to-hand fundraising where you rely on a few good people to go out and ask a few more good people for money. He was good at all of that. He was good at, he understood the political themes and trends very well, but he didn't try to position me as to what I should believe about something. What we saw as the advantage of good polling was that it would tell us where I was out of step with the trend of the constituency, and that if I wanted to do something about that, I had to go to work to persuade more people why my position was right. If my position on nuclear freeze did not share a majority in my constituency, then I had to go out and tell people why I was opposed to a nuclear freeze. Why I was opposed to even a bilateral freeze that would freeze our weapon systems as well as ours, as well as theirs, but because ours were much older, they would become obsolete at a time that the Soviet Union submarines and bombers and intercontinental ballistic missiles would still be functional, ours would not. And so that's the way we use polling to find out where there were disagreements, so that I would know that I had to be very clear to explain my view, but no point in beating a drum for something that's a minority position. You just have to explain it. So we use it that way. We also use polling to identify where pockets of strength were, so that we could aim our efforts at doing that. Brad devised, along with Margaret King, in my first congressional campaign, a campaign organization that we call the Neighbors Campaign. And I know that some other candidates have adapted something like it since then, but there was nothing like it then. What we did had a couple phases. The first phase was we would identify the precincts that would vote mostly for Republican, so that we could rank the A precincts are the ones we think we can win. The B precincts were the battlegrounds. The C precincts were ones we were going to get clobbered in. Our Neighbors campaign was aimed at turning out a big vote in the A precincts. Okay? Not stir them up in the C. That was the Democrats' responsibility to do that. Then we would get the city directory, and you'd get two copies because you had to have the odd-numbered pages cut out and the even-numbered pages cut out separately. You'd cut out the little index card size listing of the residences, the names of the people on a given street and block. There might be six residences, and they'd be listed in order from one corner to the next, and the street address. And we'd paste that on an index card that would fit our file boxes. And then you'd have to do the same thing with another set of the city directory so you could get the even numbered pages, okay? And then as those file boxes were filling up, we would recruit people to come in and work the telephone banks where they would look at that card and there would be phone numbers already written down for maybe three names on that block. And they would call any one of those numbers till they get an answer. And if the answer was no, not this time, they'd indicate that, try to get another one, go back in the box if they didn't get one. But after three names had been called, we'd give up and just let that go. We'd already contacted half of them, so why worry about straining to get contact a couple more? But where we found an ally on that method, that person would be asked to do two things: to hand out some literature for me on their street, put it in people's hands or at least hang it on their door. Second thing, fill out this little card that's stamped, send it back in saying that you did it. We had 5,000 volunteers doing that program in my first congressional campaign, and I have to believe it was a powerful secret weapon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And we did it, it maybe saved me in 76, because we still had that. It wasn't as well organized because it was too late coming together. We didn't reach as many blocks. But when I ran for governor, we did that statewide where there were city directories available. So in the cities, and ended up with 50,000 recruits in 1984. Powerful weapon, yeah.
What kind of people would be most apt to volunteer?
And that was a Brad Hayes design. Mm-hmm. So to complete about Brad,
sure.
He was a good tactician. He understood issues and policy, and he was philosophically sound, but he didn't impose that on me, either his philosophy or what the polls said. And he was technically very good, so that we had a sound basis for our campaign efforts. I don't believe I could have been elected to Congress without an ally like that. We couldn't afford to pay for the high-priced national pollsters to do all our polling. We hired DMI the first campaign, and later Lance Torrance, to do an early poll as a benchmark, and then a late poll just before the election. But we did tracking polls in between, and those were as good as the benchmark polls. You still had to have the national firm do a poll to show to business people who are wondering whether you really think you can, why do you think you can win this race? Why should I put money in a losing proposition? And they wouldn't believe our own in-house poll, but we believed in them. And they told us where the trends were, where the geographic problems were, where we needed to organize better, where they didn't know me, where I hadn't established any name identification. And you got to give Brad Hayes credit for that, and also for winning in a race for governor. I came from way behind in that race, too. The kind of people that would be the block worker in the Neighbors program.
Exactly.
Entire spectrum, no distinguishing characteristic. Men, women, children. There's no pattern of who we called, no pattern of who we got. But in most of these cards, we'd get the first name they called. And they'd say, yeah, I'd be glad to do it. And so you don't know whether somebody else would have agreed to do it. The only thing those people ever got out of it was that they constituted our Christmas card list.
Oh, that must have been some list.
Yeah, those 5,000.
Jonas had a lot of women that worked with him in the 50s, the housewives and like that. That was sort of his secret force.
Yeah.
They'd knock on doors.
Yep.
He had a real strong grassroots organization that way. And
yeah, I think Gardner did too when he ran for Congress, when he was elected to Congress and for governor the first time. Gardner girls.
Yep, a lot of young people.
We had a lot of women and young people too, but there wasn't a particular designation for that. Mm-hmm. The people that ran our phone bank were men and women. The people who put on bumper stickers were men and women and students. We made clear to students who wanted to come to our campaign that it was all right to have a little time to talk about philosophy and issues and have a good, exciting bull sure. session. But that's not going to win an election. You got to go out and get bumper stickers and yard signs and telephone calls made, or else we don't get our votes. We just have the satisfaction of thinking we were right. And in order to get them to realize that bumper stickers were important, Brad Hayes and Bob Bradshaw, my first campaign chairman, would be right out there with them, along with me. My job was, if they found somebody and said, well, yeah, I'd like to meet him first, then there I was. I could meet him. But if your campaign chairman and your campaign guru were helping to put on bumper stickers, and you're a 20-year-old college student, clearly that's not above your
sure.
place
validates
in
that
life.
Activity
yeah,
is
sure does.
Something that's awful darn important. Mm-hmm. And it does.
And it is.
Well, how are we on time?
I'm about 10 minutes from having to be to another meeting.
Oh, okay. I don't know if I should store up and get one, if I have time for a question or two.
Try one, yeah.
Was there anything here that we haven't talked about that you think is important contributing to the rise of the two-party system, or if you think there's something that's notable about how the Republican Party has changed in the past 30
years? We haven't talked a lot about the religious conservatives who have added a lot of strength to the Republican Party, and I referred to that earlier more blankly, but just indicate that we needed to have new people come into the party. And they have certainly done that and have been extremely valuable to us. Had they come in and insisted that on their issues everybody had to subscribe to the complete catechism with no backsliding, which some of them may have wanted to do, but had they organized to insist on that degree of purity, it probably would have been a very fractious relationship. But to the credit of most of them, they came in, expressed their view, and did all they could to advance their views, and yet seemed more tolerant of those of us who weren't 100% with them. They were able to see that 90% is better than 60%, or 80% better than 50%.
But there are times when...
You could also say, well, it's better to lose to somebody who's against me than to elect somebody who's not with me all the time, you know, who's only with me 9 times out of 10. But I don't believe that. I think you march yourself into a fatalistic corner if you do that.
You think the Congressional Club has done that? Like when they backed, say, Funderburk against your good friend...
Well, they didn't then. They made clear in some of my early campaigns that they could only support the candidate who was the most conservative, regardless of who had the best chance of getting elected. Go out there with your most conservative candidate, like Goldwater, and beat the drums and carry the flags valiantly into battle. And if you get beat, at least you didn't compromise anything. Later on, I think they accepted that it's better to win than lose, and to win with somebody that can help build a base so that conservative principles are more likely to prevail is better than losing with a all purist candidates. That's not to say that some purist candidates couldn't win. I'm very impressed with how well Senator Helms has been able to do with a very coherent, clear, consistent philosophy about life and politics. He didn't devise that in his first political campaign. He'd already had 2,000 editorials behind him before he...
3,000,
okay.
3,200,
wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Some odd.
So he had thousands of editorials behind him to create a coherent philosophy, and he showed that he could win a lot of voters from the middle if they respected his integrity and his thoughtfulness, and also were willing to accept that you need somebody in the Congress to take that strong position. Otherwise, you've only got people taking the strong position on the other side. And so he's a balance wheel to them, and I think it helped many middle-of-the-road voters to support him. those who are going to be polarized, they do get polarized with the Helms campaign, mm-hmm. because he's very clear what he believes. You know, there's a tendency for people to say, well, I don't agree with Jesse on everything. Well, that's a little self-serving. He doesn't agree with you maybe on everything either.
True enough.
And yet he has a clear, coherent point of view, and it has a great deal of integrity and courtesy. And America is very fortunate to have someone who can articulate that clear position, even if it doesn't always prevail. Even when you have a Republican majority, it doesn't always prevail. But America is better off to have somebody who can at least lay down what that position is and what the justification of it is. Because if you don't, all you're going to have is Metzenbaum and Kennedy and Boxer and others laying down an alien philosophy, clearly articulated, with nobody to defend against it.
How important do you think his editorials were during the 60s towards creating a fertile mindset for a Republican Party? I know some Republicans, like Sim DeLapp, wrote to Jesse and actually did a few guest viewpoint editorials. He said he thought Jesse did more than anyone else to help build the two-party system with those editorials. Were they something that you heard way out in Charlotte, or?
No, Sim DeLapp was from
Davidson County.
Davidson County, and may have heard the Raleigh stations and the network that they had. I listened to more classical music and didn't hear that.
You didn't listen to Jesse's editorials?
That was not aware of it. Didn't know who he was.
Didn't know. I know his range, it was the Tobacco Network and 53.
Yeah, it's just I was not aware of it.
Some newspapers reprinted.
When he was a candidate, I saw some reprints at the library on the bulletin board.
Huh.
Put there either by supporters or opponents, I don't know which.
Huh.
But
yeah, either one could have done
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right. And yet he ran a successful campaign then and since, and he's got to gear up in some different ways now, because he doesn't have the old alliance with the congressional club, but yet he's got a lot of the old workers there,
mm-hmm.
and he certainly has my support.
Mm-hmm.
I was with him at the head table at his dinner here 2 nights ago. Mm-hmm.
So, do you have a sense of why he and the Congressional Club have had this falling out?
Yeah, I think I understand it, but it's not my place to resolve that. I think that's between him and them.
Mm-hmm. And the basic tension, at least what I've seen in the newspapers, and I've not seen all the newspapers being in Georgia, but fundraising excesses and hints of embezzlement, is that?
No, I don't know any.
Or padded no, fees.
No. Maybe what you're getting at there is that an operation like the Congressional Club had would raise a lot of money by direct mail, and then they'd spend a lot of money trying to expand their mailing list. By running a big mailing to people who hadn't contributed in hopes that 5% of them would contribute, and then you take those 5% and they would be added to your mailing list, but that wouldn't raise enough money to pay off the large mailing.
Mm-hmm.
But on subsequent times around, you would raise enough more than it cost to do the mailings. And so a lot of money was spent raising money. Postage is not free.
Right, direct mail is expensive.
Right. And so they would put flyers in the direct mail so that you not only would get a request to send money in a little envelope to do it with, you'd also get some literature about a couple of issues that were important to you. And he still got to raise money by direct mail and direct contact of solicitors and events like the one here the other night. He still got to do all those things,
sure.
And that's still going to cost money. But I don't know that that was the cause of the rift. I'd say that was just one of, that was the nature of an organization that was devoted to intensive fundraising. Look at how many charitable fundraising organizations are able to deliver half of what they raise to the charity. Very often, 80% of it goes to the fundraising cost to pay people to do the work, to buy the stamps, get the printings, hire the consultants. The 20% that you turn over to the beneficiary organization may be $100,000 that they otherwise would never have seen, but in order to get it, a lot of good people had to come through with $500,000, mm-hmm. most of which went to pay somebody's salaries and office expenses.
Richard Vigory, I think, was the mastermind.
He was a pioneer. Yeah.
Now, I think he's...
Brad worked with him for a while.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. Huh. Early on. Maybe they were both at the Republican National Committee together. Mm-hmm. Well, Jonathan, thank you. It's good to share this with you. It'll be interesting to see how it turns out.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Good luck.